I'm not even here. I don't know where I am right now.
At least it's a fun, easy topic.
Yes.
And we got to thank Chris for coming up with this. My mother asked me last night. She goes, how did that happen?
Well, don't thank me. If it's a suck fest, then it's
no.
It's not a suck fest.
It's been fun. Hey, everyone. Welcome to Gen X Stories, a podcast about how the so-called lost generation found itself. We are your hosts, Eve, Courtney, Chris, and Lori. Yes, you're not seeing things or hearing things. There's four of us, so freaking brace yourself. Today's episode, we're going to do something totally new, like really totally new, and just see what happens. So each of us has assigned the rest of us one single Gen X album to listen to, and then we're sort of going to talk about it, and then the assigner will select, in theory, three top songs and see if we all agree. It could be fabulous. It could be a total fail. So just like Taster's Choice Coffee, let's see what happens. All right, on with the show. Hello, four people, three other people. Hi.
Good.
Hello. Morning.
We have not been able to get the four of us together for a single episode. So either it's Lori, Courtney, and Chris, or it's Chris and Lori and me, and we just can't. So it took us the fifth episode, and we're here.
Yay.
That's
yay.
Okay. We need a roll call. Bueller. Bueller.
The cool thing is that I didn't come up with this topic. I believe either we forced Chris into it or Chris came up with it, our resident musical guy. And then I misunderstood this entire thing because I thought, Chris, you were going to pick an album for each of us. You weren't going to pick an album that we all listened to. And
right.
Were you freaked out when I said, hey, where are the rest of our albums?
No, I mean, I think that ultimately what happened is we said, wait, if we do that, we could be here for 4 hours.
Yeah.
So we just tried to streamline and like everybody pick an album, everybody listen to it. Tell us what you think. You try to sort of pick something that's not too far out and something that is slightly familiar, I guess, at least that was sort of my tact. It's like I sort of tried to I'm not going to get everybody Husker Du's an arcade or something that is maybe a little bit out. Try to find something that was of the time. And it took me a while. I'm like, I had probably had a list of like 40 albums.
Oh, Jesus.
Yeah. And just kept going, nah, maybe that one. And that one came out in 2001. And I was trying to find something that was in that time period from like 1979 or actually 77 through like 93.
You're a resident musician person that we knew that you'd have a process. I didn't have any of that kind of process.
I think I shocked all of you when I didn't do Bon Jovi.
Well, we weren't going to let you do.
That would have been the obvious choice. Yes.
Yeah, we wouldn't let you do Bon Jovi. I'm sorry. If you had done Bon Jovi, I would say try again. Magic 8-Ball says try again.
But you whatever. Also picked one of my favorite albums. I was
it's
thrilled.
The best album. I know. So thrilled. There you go.
Thrilled. Well, and then the episode's over. Everybody loved it. And here we right. go.
Could be a short episode, could be a long episode. So right. that is our concept, that we each picked an album. We've given ourselves a couple weeks to listen to it. And we're going to tell you what we think about it. There's no question. The reason we're doing this is because music played a role for our generation, no matter what. Yeah. Music is sort of the barometer for a lot of us. Music is like really personal.
Yeah. I mean, it's something that not only we grew up in the age of Walkman, so then you could sort of take things around, but starting with AM radio in our early formative years into when top 40 and those kinds of things, it was sort of just kind of ubiquitous with touchstone moments as you're going through life. And it was pre-MTV and then into MTV. So there was a connection not only musically, but visually, because when MTV came out, and I think we touched on this before, is it just became like, it was just a changed everything.
Right. Change how you consume music, too.
Yep. Yeah. And you would just sit there and stare at it and go, oh, look, there's whatever for the 400th time in the past 3 days, but you still watch it. You'd
still
have it
watch
for
it.
Hours in somebody's basement.
I have albums above this desk and I took the actual record out and I have the covers. And Courtney and I were just sitting and talking and she's like, what do you have? I got to pick an album. And I told her all the ones I have above me.
Right. I turn her camera so I could see them all. They're
and like above me, there's The Cure. There's the first Madonna album. There's Cyndi Lauper's. There's Purple Rain. There's B-52s. It's like,
are these the original albums?
Well, I bought them at record stores. So
that's what I mean.
Yeah, they're the original. I went and I say, I want these. And they would look for them. And when they got them, they call me. And then they try and sell me a turntable. And I don't have a turntable. So I just took the record out and I put.
Well, now we know what to get you for this Christmas.
There you go.
But it occurred to me as we were talking about that, because she's looking for a thing. I had so many choices. I mean, there's like a Pat Benatar one, a Pat Benatar's original one. Like, what does this mean to us? Like, I didn't think it meant as much. Chris, we always know. that you are with your music. I didn't think I knew much of my music. And so in this exercise has been really cool for me to sort of listen to other things, some of which I knew, some of which I didn't know.
Right.
What we're going to do is for each album, did you hear this when you were younger and when? What did we think about the album after listening to it after all this time? And did you find out anything new?
Wait. Sorry. I didn't know I was muted. I think telling our audience up front what the four albums are might be nice.
Cool. I'm going to list for you guys, our beloved listeners. We haven't actually even shared this with our Facebook group. Nobody freaking knows. So the four albums that were selected, Chris selected The Replacements, Tim, but the new Ed Stansium mix. Lori selected Yaz, Upstairs at Eric's, but in England, they call the band Yazoo. They don't call it Yaz, which is weird. Courtney picked Annie Lennox's debut, Diva, which I thought was really fascinating. Baby. And I picked, out of all the things that I have above my desk, the Go-Go's Beauty and the Beat. So those are the four albums that we're going to talk about today. And I think we should start with our ringleader who took all this time to pick the perfect album, Chris. Talk to us about this album, Replacements, Tim, and why this version and not any other version?
First of all, they're a Midwestern band. I'm from the Midwest. I'm an enormous fan of the main singer-songwriter, Paul Westerberg, who has been sort of compared in terms of a lyricist to somebody like Bob Dylan. He's sort of always been underground. The band has sort of been underground. They were sort of the lovable losers who wanted, who had the chops like the Stones did, but they just sort of continually fucked up their career along the way.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And so Tim was their Sire Records. That was their major label debut. And if you sort of look at some of the earlier records that they had, it was very punk rock. They had like Sorry Ma, Forgot to Take Out the Trash, and Stink, and Hootenanny. And then there was Let It Be, which was a sort of a snark towards the Beatles, which was their album before Tim. And then Tim came out, and that was 1984. I remember hearing it when our local radio station, WXRT, but really didn't grab me until the following year. And so it was 85, 86 that it really was like, holy shit. And it's just, it's got punk rock in it. It's got some throwaway songs that are kind of junky, but there was an enthusiasm. And there was, at least coming from the Midwest and being a person who didn't really know what my future was, there was a certain kind of fatalistic hopelessness about it. But there was beauty in it, just in terms of the lyric. And the history of the band is just very interesting. And they're all kind of lovable losers growing up in Minneapolis. Their bassist, Tommy Stinson, started playing with the band when he was 13. His brother, Bob, was their lead guitarist, who was older. And he ended up getting kicked out of the band and then ended up dying. So they had a very interesting arc. And they should have been like, they've been enormously influential in terms of alternative rock. And a lot of people that you might sort of look at, and contemporaries really looked at that band as sort of like a real genuine rock and roll band. So that's why I picked it.
But you told me that the 2023 mix that we are recommending, why is that different than the original?
Well, I think that the story goes is that very, very quickly, the person who produced the album, Tommy Ramone from the Ramones, they were supposed to bring in somebody to mix the album, but they didn't, for whatever reason. And it was sort of buried in this kind of echoey 80s kind of stuff. So you really sort of lost the power of the band. Like the drums sounded very tinny. The mix was just sort of a mess, but it was still a great album. But then you heard it again. It just recently came out in a box set. And I heard it and was like, holy fuck, this is astoundingly sounds great. I mean, it sounds, for me at least, it sounds like it's the Midwest. It sounds like the Faces, which is Rod Stewart's first band, and Ronnie Wood, and the Stones, and a little bit of folk in there. I mean, it's just sort of this amalgamation of sort of all British early 60s music plus like Big Star. And it just blew my brain when I heard it. So, and then when I heard it again, it just completely, I mean, I've had it in my car, I think now, for about 3 weeks.
The new one, the new version. Oh, wow. Yeah. Okay. Lori and Courtney, what did you think when you heard this album?
I loved it. I played it on repeat for a couple of days. I thought it was really good. And I kept trying to think to myself, like, what does this remind me of?
Reminded me of them, I guess, because I didn't realize it quite reminded me of the tone of who they were and that time of the 80s.
It reminded me of like when I was growing up. It was the kind of stuff I would go listen to when we would go into Hollywood and hear these new bands and stuff. So it was a memory lane for me. Is it my imagination or do they sort of sound like the Psychedelic Furs?
Yeah, and they're punkier, like their earlier punky stuff before it got produced. Yeah. And those and those bands all played to those. So you had the Whiskey, you had the Metro in Chicago, you had First Avenue in Minneapolis, and all these little clubs that all of these bands who lived in a van and would just tour around.
Lived in a van.
They did. They literally lived in a van, and you could sort of DIY it, which is really a sort of a unique thing that happened with music in the 80s, which is
why it had so many great bands.
Yeah.
I loved it.
I'm glad you and if you did like it, I, oh good. Well, that's two and two.
So I loved it too. And, like, so three.
And what I thought was great is that it was, first of all, the remix is amazing.
Yeah.
Like what Jay, is it Stasium? Stasium. What Ed did was so brilliant, and you can hear the, like you feel like you're in the room with the band. That's what I loved about it. I felt like I was very present. I felt like there was an immediacy to it. There was an intimacy to it. I loved how like there was some intro to the music where the lead singer would say on this third chord. Like there's there's elements of that that made it feel like I was in a live personal performance. But I also loved. I read up. I was like, well, what? Why did he give us the remix? Like, what's the big deal? And I read up on like what it was before with Ramon and what it was with Ed and why he felt like it was important to do it. And I think that's a really interesting point of discussion in terms of who produces your music and who achieves your vision.
Right.
Because I think that's true for many artists. I'm going to take a little bit of a sidebar, but still a Gen X artist. I watched the Wham Netflix documentary and there was a lot of talk about the, I think it was Careless Whisper that was done by this very famous producer, but they didn't like it. Like someone who was well known, and so like they waited and he redid it himself and it came out the way it did. But like this notion of Ed coming back, and I feel like, I think this is why you picked it, Chris, please correct me if I'm wrong, but that this is the authentic version of this album.
Right. It's how the band sounded. And I saw them live a handful of times, and it could be like the most amazing concert you've ever seen, or just a car crash. They were notorious for just doing that. There's a story where they were like doing a showcase in New York for record executives, and they sabotaged it. They did like covers of like If I Only Had a Brain.
And Oh my God.
They were just a fucking mess. And then they did another show following that at Irving Plaza, another one of those places, and they just killed it. They just were so uncomfortable with the idea of giving away control and sort of the hypocrisy of the entire business, but that they still wanted their music to be heard.
Right.
So it was like this, they just constantly blew themselves up along the way. I mean, one of the things that I can tell you is that this tells you everything about the band. The record company was saying, we really want to do a video. We really want to do a video. And they just kept pushing back and saying no.
No.
And their first video, I think it was for Bastards of Young, was just of a guy sitting in a chair smoking a cigarette. You never saw his face until the end. And it was a speaker, and it was the bass speaker just vibrating along to the song in black and white. That was it. That's sort of like, they just always had kind of a fuck you, we're going to do what we want to do kind of attitude. And we appreciate that. But then you heard the music and the lyrics and you're like, good God, this guy is good.
Yeah.
The play on the words that Westbrook could do. And the band, they reunited briefly in 2000. It was a while back, and they played like Coachella, and I saw them at the Palladium, and they fucking killed it. I mean,
really, still.
Yeah. And there were still only two people. Chris Mars, the drummer, is an artist, and he didn't go on tour with the band, but they just destroyed the room. It was so good.
You talked about their attitude, but they sort of didn't want to sell out and all that. I mean, there's a lot of stuff about that band that represents Gen X.
Yes.
We want it the way we want it. We don't want to follow a rule. And that's kind of what I loved when I heard this, because it reminded me of back in those days saying, don't tell me what I fucking want.
Yeah. And also, like I said, that Midwestern kind of fatalism. Like, I mean, these guys were not guys that were going to go to college.
No,
they just weren't.
They're making music.
They came from working class people. They loved all kinds of music. They were going to just start a band and just give it a go and do it on their own terms. But there was always this, it was like they wanted it, but they didn't know what to do. So they're sort of lovable loser.
Lovable losers. I love that you keep calling them lovable losers. You know,
and they were very shambolic. And they were nothing glossy about these guys.
Yeah.
They just played their music.
They wanted to be authentic. I think it's interesting, though, that after the band disbanded, Paul went on to continue his career, didn't he? He was a songwriter. Yeah. Some of the stuff I wrote out when I was researching this, that some people found the replacements because they heard Paul's song
right
on the movie single.
Yeah. Dyslexic by
Cameron,
Heart.
I think it's Cameron Crowe's movie, right? I think it's Dyslexic Heart or something.
Yep.
And people love that song. And so they looked him up and then they found the Replacements and became Replacements fans.
Yeah.
Right.
And then I feel like those fans are going nuts for the new remix.
Yeah.
I didn't know. Like, I didn't until I read up about him because we're preparing for this. I had no idea that Paul Westerberg, because I knew him as a single artist. I knew him as a, right. I didn't know that he was part of the Replacements because I'm so dumb. But, and they weren't a band that I listened to when I grew up. But when I heard the sound, I'd heard one of the Replacement songs on a soundtrack and I hadn't. But now you explained that I've heard Paul Westerberg on a soundtrack for singles. And that's why, because I, until this very moment, I was like, where did this song come from? Left of Dial. I swear I'd heard on a soundtrack somewhere and I haven't. Well, it's the tone.
You've started hearing these things, particularly with music supervisors that are starting to drop these songs into movies and television with people sort of in our own age. I think the last reference that I remember hearing about was, what's it called? It's the one that's set in Chicago, the restaurant one.
Oh, The Bear?
The Bear.
The Bear.
They dropped something in one of those kinds of episodes.
Oh, no way. Okay. And I didn't even know.
And Paul's work has been in a lot of things. Even E's favorite show, Friends, he did some stuff there. Larry Sanders show, Melrose. Yeah. Like he was around. But
and to
speak to this point, like I have to say, outside of Gen X songs being put into TV shows, it's Gen X songs that are now the Muzak version in all the drug stuff.
I don't talk about that. Yeah, and then you go into Safeway, and suddenly it's like, they're playing our music in Safeway, and this is one of them. Yeah,
but then the band imploded. They famously had a last concert at Cramp, and I was actually there.
You were at the last concert.
The last concert it was at Grant Park on the 3rd of July, I think, in 1991, and then they ended up walking off the stage, and they let the roadies finish the song, finish the show.
What?
And that was it. And then they came back. They did a little tour. They did a couple of things for their second guitarist who had a stroke. And then Paul Westerberg has basically just been in his basement just making music and releasing it whenever he feels like it. He did do a album with Julia Hatfield from Lake Babies and stuff like that called the I Don't Cares, which is very lovely and poppy and that kind of stuff. But that's just what he does. It's like he puts music out when he feels like it, which is kind of cool. He's a recluse.
Okay. Which is so interesting because you listen to music and we're the behind the scenes people. And we didn't have Google back then, so we couldn't look shit up. And now we're like, oh my God, Lori's looking everything up for us.
Yeah.
And just heads up for everybody who's listening, I will provide a link to each album for you guys to read about. And then there's some links that could go off to other things so that you guys know at least the baseline.
Give it a listen too. Like, you know,
we will go to jail if we play the music. My mom asked me that too. She goes, how are you going to do an episode about the albums when you can't play the music because it's illegal? I'm like, fucking figure it out. But
look, if you guys are having a mood, I've been having a mood this past week, Dose of Thunder and Left of the Dial are great.
Left of Dial is amazing.
Like, and just let it all out.
Yeah.
Really, I think that's another thing. So when we texted about this, one of you said, this is an album you have to play loud.
Yes.
It is an album you have to play loud. So if you live next door to people, do it when people aren't there. Or if you don't give a shit, just play it loud.
Or just blow out your ears on your pod, whatever.
Yeah. One of the things I loved about it is, too, being a big fan of punk rock and like the Clash and all the local punk rock bands where I grew up, it's like they could still do like a song that would sound not uncommon, like on a Sinatra album or the last of Swingin' Party Down the Line. And the last song, Here Comes the Regular, which is just a fucking heartbreak of a song. Just like, holy shit. And then they could just tear it up with Left of the Dial and Hold My Life and everything else like that. So,
and Left of the Dial was the one that I'd heard. That's the one that I'd never heard. But then when I listened to the album, there's a commonality of that tone. Maybe it's a Lovable Losers. Maybe it's just like, they just play it hard.
Yeah.
But the story behind Left of Dial broke my heart a little bit. I didn't realize that Left of Dial is where you found all the alt channels.
Yep. Independent radio, college radio. Yeah.
I didn't know that. And one of them had heard the girl play on that bandwidth and they were trying to find her. And
he was pining after this person in another band and he heard her voice when they were driving through a town.
And for me, when you listen to songs of our youth, I remember being that totally, totally emo kid, putting everything that of my life into the lyrics of a song. And if I'd listened to that album when I was that age, it would have been a totally different story than looking at it from a research perspective. So I can see how that reflects who you are, Chris, and and the fact that you picked an album that isn't too deep for us into the punk world, but still pretty fucking edgy.
Yeah, but the thing about it is there's melody to it. You can hear all of the influences. You can hear the British Invasion. You could hear like a band like Big Star or the Raspberries or Slade. All of these just rock bands. They were just a rock band. When they grew up, they learned how to play their instruments. The chord progressions are like very unusual for punk rock. It's not three chords. It's bouncing all over the place. And the lyrics are really, 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 really well done. I mean, it's poetry.
We knew it's punk rock poetry. We know so. Punk rock. I love that punk rock. So it's lovable losers and punk rock poetry. I love that. Okay, so if you had to pick your top three songs from that album, what would they be?
Boy, it's hard. I would certainly Left of the Dial. I think Hold My Life and Here Comes a Regular because it's a heartbreaking song about a guy probably young-ish, 20s to 30s, sitting in a bar seeing his future.
Wow. You know,
that's he's going to be like one of the old guys in the back. That's it. Just drinking your life away. So.
All right. That sets the tone for how we're going to share the our albums. No, but what we're hoping is when I share my album, then you tell me something about the music that I don't fucking understand because I just look at it at a very surface level. But okay, our next one, Lori, are you ready to talk about your favorite album or your album that you had us listen to?
I have notes.
Oh, shit.
Oh, geez.
Holy shit. Okay, so.
Okay, you're not going to get any of what you just got from Chris.
That's okay,
because
tell us.
Mine is strictly like emotional memories and what it reminds me of. And so like, you're not going to get like history. So no. I pick Yaz's Upstairs at Eric's.
Great because album.
Alison Moyet's music, her sound is just, to me, second to none. I just think she's amazing. This album, I was sort of your run-of-the-mill pop music high school preteen. And this was introduced by one of my best friends in high school. And he was definitely more eclectic. And he would have been more like Chris right now, right? He just had a more diverse music palette. And I remember hearing this for the first time and just sinking in. And it was like I was a sponge to this music. It had such a profound impact on me. I just loved the sound, her voice. It just was so emotional.
Is that the first type of electronica? Because it's a very easy sound. So that's the first electronica kind of thing that you'd listen to? Because I know we were all afraid when she picked an album that she was going to pick Bon Jovi, guys. Just so because we know you love Bon Jovi.
I was not afraid. I would have welcomed that. Let's be honest.
Yeah.
But we were shocked when you picked this album because it couldn't be more 180 from Bon Jovi's popness.
Well, right. And it just, I don't know, it's just, it was so soothing. I think that's a word that I would pick for her, for her voice.
And powerful. She has a very powerful voice.
Yeah, and I don't know, it has so many memories to it.
What year did it come out?
2002.
Okay, wow, so early.
Yeah, yeah. I probably wasn't introduced to it until a couple of years after that, to be honest.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. And then all of a sudden I was like, just give me all of that kind of music. I wanted to hear it all. But this one, I just love this album. And when I picked it, I listened to it again because I hadn't heard it in a while. And I just, so great.
And did it take you back?
So it did. It took me way back. I remember where I was sitting the first time I heard it. I remember sinking into the chair. I remember just absorbing it all and like play it again.
Oh, my God. That's amazing. Play it again.
And I made my friend Stan play it like 10 times. And then anytime I would go to his house, I'm like, put it on. But like, I just.
Wow. And it was a record. It wasn't the tape. It was a record.
And it was just, I don't know, for me, it's just emotion.
Yeah. That's pretty cool.
I don't have like all the history stuff like Chris does. So
it's okay.
It
formed it, you. It formed something.
Because it was so different from anything I had heard up until that time.
I mean, like this sort of backstage, but there's some songs that are like spoken with music. That when I heard that the first time, because this is an album I grew up with, that sort of blew me away because no one was doing that.
Right.
It was sort of like not singing or speaking or laughing. And she does that laugh at the end of that song. I forget what name it is chilling, but also so freaking different. And it's two people, Chris, right? So who's there's yeah. It's Allison Vince, and there's the
Vince,
player.
Vince Clark, who ended up like going on and being in Erasure.
He did Erasure.
Yeah, he was in Depeche Mode, I think, before all of this kind of stuff. So first of all, I'm just just going to say that all of these albums were very well reviewed, basically across right. the board. Robert Christou or whatever from the Village Voice, sometimes he gets a little cranky with things. They were generally very well received and critically and popularly. Well, not necessarily in terms of album sales, but in terms of influence. And I think the thing that works about this album is that she has such a very powerful voice. And if the synthesized music at the time wasn't what we're hearing now, there wasn't a lot of sort of range to it. So there wasn't a lot of choices at the salad bar in terms of synthesizers. So the melodies were simple, but her voice and her singing could somehow elevate that. Because if you picture that album being sung by somebody who didn't have that power behind it, I don't think it would have worked.
Nope.
Because if you take her voice out of it, then it becomes almost too of the time and what, and that sort of early part of the synthesized kind of music, but certainly was influenced by Kraftwerk and stuff like that. But it doesn't have a low end. The music, her voice sort of goes from the middle to the high to the low, and it fills all of those things that you normally have, like with a big drum sound or a bass. That all of those are sort of like right in the middle in terms of the tone. Like the drum sound, it's mostly the same drum sound from a drum machine all the way through. Mm. So, but she is the one who gives it her voice, gives it the depth and the depth.
Mm-hmm.
She was the one who sought out a partner. Like, she was the one who put the ad in the paper.
Oh, really?
She was seeking someone to join her. She put an ad. Vince responded, and actually they went to school together. So they actually knew each other.
Right.
And then they formed the duo for a little while.
Yeah. Oh, that's amazing. So you did your research too, of course, because you're a historian. What else did you think about this album, Court, having listened to it?
It's one of my favorite albums. I mean, I grew up with this. I still listen to the song. I mean, Only You.
Yes.
Yeah.
Heartbreaking.
That's very, very
strong
song.
Heartbreaking. And there's been some acoustic versions of it, which is just still, I mean, the songwriting stands alone. It's just phenomenal situation. I mean, I used to like jog to this album. It
was just
so great. Don't Go, of course. But I think it's interesting that like Only You was supposed to be the first single, but in actuality, the B-side Situation, which is a great song, as well, was the one that was released for their first album, and it probably garnered them a lot of fans at the outset. And then when you listen to the whole album, this was different. Like, one of the reasons we wanted to listen to albums and not just songs is that when we were growing up, the album was constructed to be listened to as a whole album.
Right.
And it's very different than how people today listen to music, where you can pick and choose the individual songs. And so listening to the whole album makes a difference in how you can appreciate all the different songs and the messages within them and what it means.
Well, and the interesting thing, you just mentioned the word B-side. And for anyone who's too young to remember albums, the reason it's called a B-side, it's the flip side of the freaking album.
Or the single, you know,
But when you talk about people now, you just pick a song on Spotify. But I love that point, which is it was constructed in a certain way to be listened to as a whole in an album. I can't imagine now listening to any of these songs separately and just like picking a song out and then putting the next. I mean, even though playlists, we've done that.
Right.
But growing up, it was cool that we didn't have to. And then, I mean, were you, Lori, was it the poppy songs that you were gravitating to? Was it the ones that were the less popular songs that you gravitated to? It was just the whole thing as a unit that you liked.
You mean this particular album?
Yeah, this album.
Oh, no, the whole album.
The whole album.
I mean, it's like. Courtney said it's constructed. I can't imagine just picking, like you just said, picking a song. I mean, yeah, there's the popular songs, but it's what's the whole mood. When I picked it, I thought, oh, I'm going to, I hit replay. I can't tell you how many times.
Me too.
Because it'd been a while since I'd listened to it. And all the memories.
It was a very, at least in my environment, and I'm thinking of a place in Chicago called Medusa's. And Medusa's was sort of like an alternative dance club. And you could get into it underage. And okay, so it had everybody from sort of the pre-goths. This is 84 up through like 88. And even the punk rockers, it's like people still dance to this. You know, this is the thing that you put on people with dance. And everybody liked it. Especially like you'd hear Don't Go and then you'd hear something by Naked Ray Gun following it. But it was like one of those kinds of things. I also do remember very distinctly in college and the latter part of high school, this was a very, very popular album for women of that
time. Yes, yes. That's how I got it. That's how I heard about it.
And there was a voice that people reacted to, not only just the music, but the voice as well. Yeah. Powerful. Like even in Heartbreak, it was powerful. And a woman's point of view, which let's face it, it's a dick party in rock and roll most of the time. And women's voice is in some ways more interesting because it's like a different point of view. At least for me, it's like there's enough dude rock bands out there.
I got to see them live. It must have been 10, 12 years ago. They came here to DC to the 930 Club. I don't know why.
A tour. They reunited and did a tour.
And so I don't think it was a new album. I think they just did that. And I remember going with a dear friend who unfortunately passed away. And she and I waited in line outside. And we looked around at all the people and we're like, they're all guys. There were not as many women who came to watch this. It was us. And all the guys came to listen to Allison sing. Which I thought was really fabulous. We were surrounded by a bunch of guys who were considerably younger than us. And my friend Jenny wanted to take some of them home. And we did not. But I remember she was a music fanatic. She's like, do you listen to Yaz? I'm like, oh my God, yeah, I used to listen to Yaz all the freaking time. And she's like, they're coming to your town. I'm coming up and we're going.
Otherwise, I
wouldn't have done it. You are the mosh pit. Mm-hmm. We got there early enough that we were close to the stage. Mm-hmm. And I remember I took videos. I think I took videos of the cute guys who were behind us. Mm-hmm. But I was a quote unquote adult.
2008. Because they had a bad breakup. Like after 2 years.
Oh, they did.
Right, Lori. Yeah.
Yes.
I wondered. They didn't last long.
Lack of communication.
Really?
And then Alison Moyet had a big falling out with her record companies and contracts and stuff. So she disappeared. Like she basically was kind of frozen out because of her contracts. Way to go, industry.
Right. Which is a common story, right?
It's a very common story. The entire music industry is not user friendly. But one of the things I did want to point out is we're going through all of these albums are coming from people who were independent. I think out of all of these albums, Beauty and the Beat and Diva were the biggest, hugest things, but the bands themselves
were not
started out left of the dial. Like they were not necessarily bands and that sort of point, there's an integrity to all of these, whether or not you groove on the music. And I like all of these albums, whether or not you groove on the music, there's a respect that you give to this because there's an integrity about it. All of it
reflects who we were. I think that our music had to hit a certain bar. We had to have music that believe it was true to them because it is reflective of us at that time because we found us in them.
Right.
In a lot of ways. And
that's what music is about, right? You hear that you hear your own part in it.
Yeah.
You can connect to your life to it. It becomes a little bit of your song as much as somebody else. And that's for somebody who can do that. I am in awe of
Me
that.
Too.
Like
Me
that
too.
Is just such a remarkable gift to the universe to be able to write a song that just grabs you.
Lori, top three. What are your top three songs from that album?
Top three. In My Room, Only You.
Of course.
And Don't Go.
Yeah.
There you go. Baby. That's it right there.
Yeah, baby.
That's it. That encapsulates a whole piece of Gen X, those three songs.
Mm-hmm.
Courtney, we're moving on to you and your album, Annie Lennox's Diva. Tell us this album, what it meant to you, why you picked it, all that good stuff.
Well, it came out in 92. I've loved Annie Lennox for a long time.
Well, yeah.
And Annie, she's probably most famous for being part of a band called the Eurythmics with Dave Stewart. She actually was performing with a band in the 70s before that called the Tourists, where she was the lead singer. She was dating Dave for a while. And after they stopped dating, they came together and created the Eurythmics. Their first album was okay in 1981, but they got their biggest hit, especially with the opening song with Sweet Dreams Are Made of This, Sweet Dreams Are Made of These, which is about drug use. And that was in 1983. So she's most famous for that. And they were together for about 10 years. And then she took a break. She had her daughter. And while she was on break and a new mom, she started writing all these songs on her own, all these lyrics, all these thoughts. And she was reflecting on fame, reflecting on what her life had become over the past decade. And now she's bringing new life into this world. And what did that mean? And what was the message she wanted to give to her child? And she was processing everything that had happened in that decade. Mm-hmm. So this album is deeply personal. And because she's so smart and she's so gifted lyrically, really takes on these like bigger ideas, these bigger themes that we all grapple with. But in her case, really sort of like, what is the price I'm willing to pay for my success? Like, what is the bargain I'm making with fame in order for my music to be heard? Like, we all have that bargain in some different way in our jobs, maybe not as overtly as this. And I really felt like her reflecting on her evolution as an artist and then what she hopes for in the future was really what was revealed in Diva. And I loved it. I mean, the opening song is Why.
Yeah.
And I think that sets the tone for the whole album because it really talks about
song.
The fact that she's in, right, Lori? It's her inner world. She's trying to understand. Yeah. She's opening up to you saying, I'm trying to figure all this out. Come on the journey with me, which is why, ladies and gentlemen, you got to listen to the album in the order it was originally released. Because the final song is one of my favorites, Little Bird.
Yeah.
And it's talking about when she's feeling low, wanting to fly away, falling out of the nest, and then realizing that you're blessed. And that her big thing in the song is you got to put these wings to test. I'm going to start crying. You got to put these wings to test because you've got to get up and try and do it on your own, which is also, I mean, subtext doing it separately from Dave Stewart doing a solo versus a duet album.
Right.
So it speaks to that as well. But like just as an anthem, that's the last song. That she is like going to put forth this album, which is very personal to everybody, and let it fly. So I just love the album as a whole. It really spoke to me at the time. It has spoken to me for the decade since. I still listen to it regularly.
Really?
There's some funny songs too. There's a song in there called Keep Young and Beautiful.
Yes.
And it's done as if it's in an old time radio. It's got little crackles and stuff. So it's supposed to be sort of pseudo 1920s, but it's reflective of every era of what it means to be representing yourself as a woman in public. She's doing it as sort of like as the big picture fame, but it relates to all of us. We all have our war paint we got to put on and get out there. Keep young and beautiful. You got to be thin. You got to be pretty. You got to do this. So it speaks even to today across all generations. I think that's just fantastic. Broken Glass is just like such an amazing song. I mean, there's so many hits on the song and so many wonderful things, but my top three would be Keep Young and Beautiful, Broken Glass with a Little Bird would be my favorite song on it. I mean, Money Can't Buy It and Legend and Living were still like, oh, can't say goodbye to those. But anyway, I loved it. I hope you guys enjoyed it.
It was amazing to go back to it.
Yeah.
It was amazing to go back to it because it'd been a while. And I had the great fortune of seeing the Eurythmics.
Oh.
And she is... The power in that woman is unbelievable.
Right.
She's just, you were talking earlier about powerful women. I mean, she's just
everything
else.
Yeah.
I mean, she's everything in so many ways and for so many reasons. I mean, her just, she doesn't give two shits. She's just doing her music and she's
Annie
Lennox.
She has a lot of integrity.
But I mean, she's just Annie Lennox. So like, that's all you have to say is Annie Lennox.
Who that is.
Yeah.
The voice, you know, the persona.
Yeah. And everything she stands for now, she's just an outgoing activist.
Yep.
And she's
just
still amazing.
Present in our lives these days, even if it's not in releasing music.
Right.
I think it's interesting of the albums that we selected. She's the only one who's a solo and just goes by her name. Everything else we've done is a band. And I love that we have a debut solo album that to me sounds so very different because I love the Eurythmics. I love that the two of them, even though he didn't sing, the tone of it.
He produced
right.
it
all. Right.
And she's the same voice, but the tone of the music is entirely different. So when I started, I hadn't listened to this album in years. And it seems softer, but stronger. In a lot of ways. And I remember listening to this just now going, if I'd listened to this, I don't know if I would have gotten it. If I wasn't going through a different age, I wouldn't have understood it. I don't think. I think I would have sort of said, oh, that's really pretty. It's a nice thing. I don't think I would have gotten it.
That's what I think is great about the album. Like as you listen to it at different ages of your life, it takes on different meaning. And it speaks to what Chris was saying earlier. A great song speaks universally, stands at the time, touches you in different ways as you engage with the world around you. I think it was also interesting because Chris, you were talking about the replacements and like the fame, the control and the hypocrisy of like the record business, right?
Oh yeah, it's a mess.
Caused them to sort of like self-sabotage.
Yeah.
And in a way, Annie Lennox is like a decade later than, well, like 6 years later than their ending of their band. She's doing the same thing, but she's doing it through her music in a reflective way. And I just kind of wish the Replacements could have stayed together and like poured that out into like another album.
Yeah.
I think that would have been amazing.
You know, what I like about the album is that, and you did bring up a very good point, is that it is a solo album. So it's not a band putting this album together, but her. And a lot of the times when you have those kinds of things is that a producer or the production of the album can basically overpower the artist's voice, can overpower the lyrics, it can overpower that. Sometimes because it's of the time, and that's kind of what radio-friendly record companies want. They want to have, that's why we hear all that very echoey stuff in the 80s, the big, the gated sound that we heard like from Phil Collins and the drum sound and stuff like that. All of the people that worked on this album were like rock star session musicians, the supporting band. And it is of the time, but it holds up.
Yeah.
And a lot of less capable or artists can be lost in like the mix of the time. And it doesn't it doesn't bother you, even though you can hear the early 90s sort of mixes. It still is strong. And that's also a testament to professional session musicians going and kill it. I mean, just show up and do it. And a good producer who will let the artist's voice come through and not completely overshadow what, I mean, you're basically there to just put everything together.
Support the artist.
And stay out of the way and let the voice come through and make suggestions, but not overpower and not just put lacquer over.
What you're saying, Chris, to me says that she was respected.
Respected
by her fellow musicians.
Yeah.
She was respected by the producers. Like, it tells me that she commanded the room to make sure that her vision was collaborative, but also still stayed on her track. So I think that speaks volumes, especially for someone who had always been in a band before. Mm-hmm. And I think also too, because she had been in a band and had such success for such a long time, she wasn't like a brand new artist coming out and trying to navigate the world. She'd been in a studio before. She understood how it worked. Like, that experience, I think, helped her create a solo album that was probably unique in terms of a solo debut album.
Yes. And also both Dave Stewart and Annie Lennox really understood the connection to the visual. And if you remember at the time, they were making videos that were very expensive, very well done, very well lit, very well cast. It fit perfectly. And a lot of these things, the videos, as I recall, and I haven't seen them in a lot of years, is that she was almost like the Joel Grey character in
Cabaret,
where she was kind of the narrative to the narrative of the song. But she understood that. And it's like, you always felt in the same way that like Madonna's early stuff, she owned it. Like she was going to decide what her voice was going to be, how it was going to be put out there. And I am the person in charge of it. And I always respect people who do that.
And you mentioned the visual part. I hadn't listened to the album. Like, I know you must listen to it all the time, Court. I hadn't. But when I saw the cover, it reminded me of what she looked like when they did these videos. And I remember the bright colors and I remember the luminousness of her skin and how much you saw her in these songs. It was different because, like, even I'm thinking about Upstairs at Eric's, they're not on the cover. It's two mannequins.
Right.
So she's out there in front alone. That meant a lot, I think, for our growth at that time, saying, look what she could do.
Yeah. And just strong. Like, she's like, this is my album. Thank you very much.
I would imagine that would have been very scary at that time because she had had such an enormously successful career as the Eurythmics. And then to go on her own, like, oh, do you have the balls to do that? And she's like, yeah, I do.
And the chops.
I have the talent. Right.
And I have the talent. Great album. Great album.
See, so far we like all these albums, which is when you do a podcast, you sort of don't want anyone to agree because I'm like, yes, I totally agree. But it's the insights that we hear. And I think, Chris, you're in an interesting position because being the only guy with three women who shared their albums that were integral to us growing up as women is fascinating. Because to see it from your perspective, too, is odd because I never thought about that because we've picked a lot of strong fucking women.
Right.
So
there you go.
All right. Well, then I guess it's my turn.
Your turn.
All right. And here's the thing that I'm most concerned about here, because I don't know the shit that other than Wikipedia
says. Me neither.
Right. So I will pull a Lori and tell you about the album and why I like it. The album is Beauty and the Beat by the Go-Go's. Even though I didn't know shit that I know now about them, the Go-Go's represented that girl power as a young person, because this came out in 82, I think.
It was 81.
81, actually. Right. And it is their debut album. That was my entry into them. Chris will tell us all about their punk roots because they have these crazy punk roots. I didn't know them as a punk band. I heard them on the radio or saw them on MTV. And there was something about the group of women playing music, playing guitars.
Right.
Playing electric guitars.
They were a band. Yeah, they were a band.
They were a band. And I loved that about them. I loved Belinda Carlisle. We all know eventually went off and did her own thing. And I did follow her. I did not know necessarily all of her struggles. And the drug addiction was significant in that band. But the Beauty and the Beat, when Courtney asked me about the albums that are above my computer, the one in the middle is this album, is Beauty and the Beat, with them in their towels around their head, towels around their body. And for some reason, I gravitated to that because it was just so, again, authentic. it represented a bunch of women who were like, I'm not going to make myself pretty, pretty girl. When I saw the documentary, they told a story that I didn't know. Where those towels came from on the album cover?
Probably somewhere terrible. No.
The story goes that they went to Macy's. They had an idea of what they wanted on the cover. Right. They bought the towels.
Right.
They wore them and they were so broke, they took them back.
Oh, no. Yeah. It's hysterical.
Which I love. There's a realness to it. And their sound was so different. If we grew up with Eurythmics and we grew up with sort of the synthesizer sound, and I was a Madonna freak, but these girls were just so flippin' different to me. Maybe because she was a goofy blonde. I really gravitated to Belinda Carlisle. But Weldon is like the heart of that band in so many ways. The little dark haired one who plays guitar.
Right.
Rhythm. And I watched the videos. Our Lips Are Sealed made the video where they were going around L.A. in an open convertible. I didn't know a lot of it. I didn't know that they were so hot that day. The reason that they had her at the end of the thing in a fountain is because they were just so flipping hot that they really wanted to cool off. And they thought maybe they'd get arrested and they could get it on the video, which speaks to me to that independence. And the sound was something really new to me. Like it was the surf music. There's a little bit of that to it, but there's
Southern California. Yeah.
Yeah. There's a popness, just something about those songs that I want to be like them. And I want to have girlfriends like that. I want to have a group of people who are going to take me in an open top convertible and we're going to go to a lingerie store and I'm going to be so embarrassed. I'm going to sit outside like Jane Weldon and wait for you to go buy your bras. That's what I wanted. So I don't know a whole lot about them before them. I know a lot about them afterwards because they did do this documentary where they talked about the drugs. They talked about them breaking up. I saw them on one of their farewell tours. They came to DC and they played the Warner Theater. And Kathy Valentine, who I think was their bass player, left the band by that point. But they sounded the same.
Right.
Jane Weldon was right in front of me. And you could have put her 30 years before and she would have sounded exactly like that on the music. And I know they've been through a lot of shit by then. And Chris, I'm sure you will tell us about all that shit and what has happened to them. But I've seen them twice live. The second I have the opportunity as a grown up to see them, I will see them because they're just that good. So I don't know.
Well,
I love
that they were real musicians.
Yes.
They weren't just like this girl pop, whatever. Right. They were real musicians. They played the instruments. They were powerful. They were no nonsense. And
yes.
Yeah, they had like these issues. Upbeat pop songs and stuff. But I just thought that was another, like, I hadn't heard it in a while. So listening to it again, I was like, oh, yeah.
Yeah. And you mentioned that they play their instruments. The Go-Go's were the first all-female band to write their own songs and play their own instruments. Because if you remember, like Robert Plant was big at that day. They had the girls with the outfits in the back and they were just.
That's what I mean. They were put. Yes. They weren't props.
And they were all girl bands before the Go-Go's. They just weren't at the same level of.
Yeah,
I can't say that the Go-Go's had 100% control, but they did write and play their instruments. So that was what was unique. There were a lot of all-girl bands before them that were singers, but didn't necessarily do all their own music. So that's what made the Go-Go's really unique at the time. And I mean, I think their history coming out of sort of like this, like, well, if these idiots can, they were friends with all these band guys. If these idiots can do it, we can do it. And they went through many iterations. And they were kind of like a joke to start with. And they were just saying, whatever, let's do it. And then I can't remember Gina.
Yeah, Gina Shaw.
She came from, hello, people, Baltimore.
Baltimore, that's right. She's a Maryland girl.
Baltimore in the house. And she showed up in the band and she's the one who got them. Let's get organized. Let's have regular rehearsals. Let's actually put together something serious. And they became actually the band that we sort of know today. And it was, I think it was her. I was reading something. I'm sure you researched this as well. But like, she was like, I don't know, hungover or drunk, like watching Motown and Twilight Zone and came up with We Got the Beat. Like, I don't even understand how that happened, but the magic sauce was there. And that's the riff that launched them, really. I mean, it's kind of amazing.
They do talk about trying to get a label to produce them and they couldn't.
Right.
And they eventually got produced by IRS Records. And one of the things I saw said, you only go to IRS Records where no one else will produce you.
But if you look at the roster of IRS, one of the things that IRS had is because they were a smaller label. Stuart Copeland's brother was one of the founders of IRS. And so they had sort of a punk.
Stuart Copeland is one of the members of the Police.
Yes. So they had
just for our audience,
and they had this roster of really very, very, really great bands. I mean, it's where REM was from. The Go-Go's were there. I think The Alarm.
Yeah.
I mean, just bands after Wall of Voodoo, all of these bands. And they didn't have a lot of money.
Right.
So their promotional kind of stuff was still a little DIY. But the Go-Go's, I think, just hit it at the time that was perfect for their sound.
Yeah.
They wrote all their stuff. They were an all-female band, but they didn't like pander.
Right.
They were tongue-in-cheek. And just in terms of the sound, if you listen to some of the songs on there, you can still hear like some of the sort of mod punk stuff that came out of not only Los Angeles, but also out of the UK. Like with the, you can hear like the
Absolutely.
Jam in them and that kind of, those kinds of bands. Not as much like the Clash, but you can hear the punk things in some of those things that are not overly slicked out. And some of the songs were slicked out. If you hear them live compared to or some of the earlier recordings of them live compared to what was on the records, it's very different.
Yeah, rough.
But they also got a really good producer who knew how to tweak into a hit. And when you heard that song on the radio, you're like, God damn, that's a hit. That is the summer song. And it nailed mm-hmm. it. It was just the two big singles on it. We got the beat and Our Lips Are Sealed. Nailed it. Like
nailed it.
It just was perfect song of the time when it was released. Timing was everything. Great songs, but like a different year or a 2 years later or coming
maybe
out
not.
At a different time. Maybe not.
Yeah.
One of the things too that is interesting is, like you said, they wrote most of the music and whatever. Our Lips Are Sealed. I forget who the female writer, but one of the co-writer on that was one of the guys from The Specials.
Oh, okay.
And it was sort of about a relationship that was
I thought she pilfered that. She was having a relationship with them and it was like a love letter and she pilfered it from the love letter.
Sort of, yeah. I mean, I don't know all the little parts, but there's always the thing that's interesting about all these bands, especially from like the 70s through, I don't know, like mid 80s, 87 or whatever, there was a support. Like even there might've been petty jealousy at the base level. Somebody gets a deal or somebody's record hits. It's like, but everybody knew everybody because you were like, there was just this, like you needed a place to stay. Somebody knew somebody who could let you crash on your van tour through the Southwest. And when you're going through Mesa, Arizona, it's like, yeah, this person's cool with bands. He'll let this, he or she will let you sleep on the floor. So there was this camaraderie about doing it yourself.
Yep.
That was kind of cool. And the Go-Go's were definitely of that. They weren't the Germs, which was just like this complete car wreck of a band, very powerful, but like dangerous. But there was danger in it. I mean, you see this. It's like they behaved just as badly as the Replacements did back when they're out touring and drinking it up and drugging it up. I mean, I'm not making light of it, but like they were in it. Yeah, they were legit. And not that makes you legit, but that's, they were immersed in the world.
It's interesting because the documentary covers a lot of that, which I didn't know about, and the other boy bands that they traveled with and they opened for and were in relationships with.
Yeah.
And then I guess right before in the beginning of the pandemic, if you guys remember, I think they re-released Our Lips Are Sealed and they were all in their own little box.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I remember that.
But their tours were over.
Right.
But there was still some respect for that.
Probably.
But when I went back and I did the research, they called them New Wave. And I don't know if I would have considered the Go-Go's a New Wave band. I consider them a pop punk. I consider them their own thing. But when they labeled it New Wave, is that what you're talking about? Like the influence of the Brits coming over and some of the stuff?
And I also think it was just something to categorize. It was just helpful for the AOR record people to be able to just say, this is it. I mean, the Talking Heads at times got labeled as New Wave and they weren't. They were punk rockish art stuff or television or even like the Modern Lovers, Jonathan Richman and stuff like that. It wasn't necessarily New Wave. It still had that punk ethic, but it wasn't as hardcore and it didn't have like people weren't dressed in leather and didn't have the Mohawks like the Clash. And maybe it had a little, I don't want to say softer, but just not as
different.
Maybe not as aggressive. And it did have a pop sensibility. And I think that most people would sort of like, a good song's a good song, doesn't
matter.
But it did have a certain kind of sound to it too.
Yeah. It wasn't
necessarily, which is kind of different for the Go-Go's because they were a band and it was guitars and bass and drums. New Wave, I sort of think, had more of a synthesizer kind of quality.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It felt very rock. And when you see Jane Wilden doing her guitar, her electric guitar, and she's still wearing the cute little skirts and she's still the cute, the girly, but it's like, dude, your music's hardcore.
Yeah. I mean, it's based in punk rock, but and a surf punk, the surf punk kind of stuff and sort of that Dick Dale guitar.
Yes.
A little
Dick
twang
Dale,
to it.
Yeah. That's what I liked.
if you're going to just drop an album that was perfect of the time, I think out of all of these kinds of things, that's the one that like came from a small label and it just exploded. Yep. Like you could not turn the radio on without hearing Our Lips Are Sealed or We Got the Beat. Like
right.
just all the way across the dial from left to right, that's where it was. And it was well deserved. It's a really, really good album. It still holds up.
And it was so in trying to pick the top three was tricky with this album because mm-hmm. Our Lips Are Sealed and We Got the Beat are the ones that come out of it. For some reason on this album, I've always loved This Town.
I love that song. Oh,
I love that song.
And I'm
that's the one that sounds like the Jam. It right, sounds like a Jam song. That's the
one I put as one of my favorites for this album.
Yeah.
And I wonder if it's because of it's sort of it's a minor key, but it sounds different. It's not up. It's hard, sure, the ones that we do. And then I really hadn't spent a lot of time on the other ones, but Skid Marks on My Heart is sort of fucking awesome.
Yeah, dumb title. I mean, it's just sounds like teenage death poetry type.
Yeah, I know. But when you listen, it's a good song. And it has the poppiness, but when you listen to it, it's like, dude, this is some heartbreak.
Right.
Thing. Oh, see, I like Less to Love.
Lust to Love is also good, and it has that's that good, kind of yeah. darker edge to it too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it's hard to love this album without loving those two hits.
Well, no, that's a given. Those are the perfect. Givens.
But I think This Town and Lust to Love and Skid Marks on My Heart are probably the B-side angles of this that I really dig and that I also listen to.
That's great, Eve.
This is a fun exercise. What do we think about this? Did this work for us? Did you guys enjoy doing this little experiment?
I loved it.
I would do it. This is something I'd come back to. I mean, listen, I got 40 lined up. 40 or more I could throw out there. That
my God.
Well, that's why I was really excited to do this because I knew that Chris was going to take notes. Maybe we do this again and we do less well-known albums. So then Chris can pull up some one of his Husker Du's or Lori. We still can't do
some
Bon Jovi.
Of them that you won't like.
No,
yeah, it's okay. But
I'd have to bring some Morrissey in here, people.
Yes.
We won't talk about his vile personality, but no, he we'll makes talk about really good music.
The Smith.
Oh, yeah. My God. What I also loved about doing this with you guys is I've learned about your personalities a lot. Your choices have revealed something very cool about you. And have revealed, like, as you've grown into a grown human versus what you were like when you were younger. I learned a lot by these choices.
Yeah. Because
it was like, why did Lori pick... Yes. Holy shit. That was amazing. And Courtney, you had mentioned Annie Lennox at one point. I think she'd mentioned Diva somewhere in one of our episodes. So I wasn't totally surprised. But when I listened to it, I was like, I could see you all over that album. And Chris, my God, listening to The Replacement was like, yeah, of course. Of course. So one of the research links that I shared that I happened to find, I'm going to put in our notes. It is, if those of you read McSweeney's, which is all satire, and it's McSweeney's Internet Tendencies. This year, this August, they wrote an open letter to the pair of Gen Z men in the Northeast Regional Quiet Card loudly discussing Pitchfork's number 100 best albums of all times. And it starts, gentlemen, your opinions on the discovery of the last 50 years interests me about as much as you think a middle-aged woman traveling coach to Boston with an L.L. Bean boat tote filled with crackers. I read Mild. I read Invisible. I read probably all I listen to is Ripple by the Grateful Dead. Here's the thing, though. I know who Fugazi is. And you will never grow beards because of the xenogens in your plastic water bottles. Don't be fooled by my comfortable and supportive footwear, my tie-dye rainbow Crocs. I know a lot about music. Mm-hmm. And she goes on. It's fabulous. And it references a lot of albums of our time.
Right.
In the snarkiest Gen X-y way you could possibly imagine. So I'm going to put that in the link. It made me smile because I read it after we selected our albums. And thinking about this, talking to one of our kids, Courtney and Chris, you've got kids in that generation.
Oh, I'm so happy she likes the music. Then.
And she does.
You've done it right. If they yeah. like,
she likes the Clash.
Yes, right. And you would
likes
not have
the
this.
Foo Fighters.
I thought of you with this article. I was like, this is not a conversation Chris is ever going to have with his teenager because she gets the music.
There's a documentary that I think Rhino put out about the Replacement redo.
Cool.
So let's make sure we put that link in because I think that's really. Great. Okay. It's short cool. and sweet. And I think it really establishes that process.
And then, I mean, there are a lot of documentaries. There's the Go-Go's one. You mentioned the Wham one. Mm-hmm. There've been, we have the pocketbooks now. So a lot of Gen X type music
is either being used in advertising or they're putting a documentary out about it so that you learn a little bit more of it. But it's worth sort of listening to and sort of seeing why we love these so much. All right, guys, that's it for us this week. The experiment worked. Yay. We're going to do it again. Thanks for listening to us on Gen X Stories. Drop a note at hello@genxstories.com and we may do some shout outs on a future episode. And oh, you guys are tired of hearing me saying this, but we have merch. Go buy some. It's real cool shit. Find out all about it on our website at genxstories.com. You can also subscribe to Gen X Stories on your favorite podcast app, write us a kick-ass review, follow us on Instagram at Gen X Stories, or join our ever-growing Facebook group. We all have a Gen X story. What's yours?